The Afterburn Podcast is a proud supporter of Guns Gear and Memorial Foundation, helping our veterans and their families when they need it most. To learn more, visit gunsgearin.com/rain.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
And we had this narrow single engineer speed range we could fly at. So I had to trade our altitude in that hover instantly to get to a survivable airspeed with one engine. Because you can't hover this 18,000 pound helicopter at 7,000 feet with one engine. And the alternative was to just crash the aircraft straight into the ground and try to cushion it as we do a power assisted vertical descent. And that didn't seem like a good idea. So the other really scary thing was my buddy, one of our PJs, is on the hoist.
Tower to my stations, release you, runway 4 left, 0 0 at 5, clear for takeoff.
Seat tied, Altoona 0 eyes, we're clear for takeoff, clear for the airspace.
Fire project through.
Low speed, my friend, today. My friend, Ram Carapaz at 354.
So yeah, that's on.
Hey, welcome to the podcast. Thanks for listening in. This is a rebroadcast because many of you weren't here 3 years ago when this first showed up. And I have Shiner coming back on the podcast for episode 89. We're not going to talk about his distinguished flying crosses like we do in this episode where he breaks those down. We talk a lot about the combat search and rescue and how it's changed and transformed. He's a commander now. So you'll have to check out his episode. It's available now on Patreon. It'll be coming out here in the next few days. But I thought it'd be appropriate to re-release this so you get a little bit more backstory of who Shiner is and some of the things he has done. Quite a spicy few weeks for him back a few years ago in Afghanistan, to say the least. So I think you'll enjoy this. If you heard it, try to re-audio engineer it just a little bit. Clean it up because, again, the technology has changed since I first started this and hopefully have learned a thing or two. But if you are enjoying this content, again, I always ask, follow the show over on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, leave a rating or review. That helps the show out. And if you're interested in There I Was stories and supporting the podcast, great way to do that is over on Patreon. But again, just leaving a rating or review and sharing the show with a friend or family member helps this thing grow. And I appreciate each and every one of you who take the time to do that. So let's get into it. This was originally a two-part series, so you'll hear that in the middle. I'm just going to re-release it as one episode. But we broke down both of his distinguished flying crosses, as I mentioned earlier. So, with all being said, let's jump into the episode with Shiner.
Well, awesome. Shiner, thanks for joining me on the podcast today. You have quite a journey and some interesting stories, which we're definitely going to dig into. Before you roll into the podcast, will you tell me a little bit about who you are, what you're doing today, and how you got there?
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Rain. So Lou Nolting, go by Shiner. I grew up Colorado, kind of on the Front Range there in Golden, West Denver. Knew I wanted to fly from a young age, and it was really cool at the inaugural DIA air show when they opened Denver International. And as a kid, my dad took me there and I got a ride in the original T-6. And they had to stack two parachutes and the pilot had to like say, yeah, one pilot refused. And the other one's like, yeah, we'll just stack parachutes for him. And we did a barrel roll and it was pretty great. And I was 10 and that just always stuck in my mind. And so I did some research and I applied to all 5 service academies, including Merchant Marine. Nice. And a bunch of ROTCs, right? And got into Merchant Marine and accepted that appointment. And then at the last second, got a letter from Air Force Academy saying, hey, you know, drive an hour south from Golden and join our class. So I did that.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Pretty cool.
Yeah, quite a glove save from being around floating around the ocean for 9 months.
I know. Well, supposedly they have Navy pilot slots or Coast Guard that they never fully fill or that they have opportunities. So that was kind of my angle there. But I'm pretty seasick, so it would have been bad.
That's awesome. Well, it's cool to hear that. You know, I get a mix of people. I think you and I kind of similar in that sense. Like, I got an aviation hook pretty early on, and then my whole focus was like, I want to go be an Air Force pilot. But there are a lot of people who are just kind of out there floating around. They don't necessarily know they want to go out there and fly. But sounds like you're the first case where you knew. In high school, I assume everything was kind of geared towards getting to a service academy and getting a pilot slot, right?
Yeah, that's right. And I was just fortunate that I had that focus and the knowledge and the support to kind of piece that together. I got my private in high school, so that was pretty cool. I got my private pilot right as I kind of got my driver's license, so maybe a little after. But I grew up rock climbing and ice climbing. We'd go scout lines in the foothills there and figure out where we wanted to climb with the plane. It was super cool.
That's awesome, man. Yeah, I got my pilot's license in high school as well, and I think that's pretty unique. But it's one of those things that it's not a requirement to have a pilot or your pilot's license going into the Air Force Academy or ROTC in order to get a pilot slot. But it's definitely one of those things that I think helps. And probably flying around in Colorado, that's some airmanship that you developed at a pretty young age that you can translate, I imagine, into flying HA-60s, which is what you do now, right?
Right. And I think that mountain flying, that lower altitude using the winds kind of hooked me and pulled me in towards the low-level helo tactical mindset. So I kind of knew that existed going into the academy, and they'll come and land at the Terrazzo, kind of the center square there at USAFA, and we'll get to talk to those dudes. So I was able to see them as a cadet and be exposed to that.
What was the hook that made you go like pursue a career flying HA-60s and doing combat search and rescue?
So at UPT, I'd flown private pilot. I'd never been airsick at all. And then in the T6 from like day one, I was super sick. And I worked super hard to cope with it, but I never fully kicked it. And like half my mental energy was devoted to just keeping my body calm, basically, as far as air sickness went. And I had this hunch that I could do kind of a hard, fun, adventurous tactical job with helicopters and maybe not be super sick. And I was right. And I'm super lucky that that opportunity existed.
Yeah. Did you know anything about CSAR or anything like that going through pilot training, or did you have any mentors that guided you that?
Well, when I was a cadet, Anaconda, so I was the first 9/11, post-9/11 class at USAFA. So 9/11 had just happened. Anaconda just happened. And then the Iraq War kicked off in 03. Colonel Kim Campbell, I think captain at the time, flew her 810 back and came and talked to us as cadets. And that was pretty cool. And she was I'm not sure if she was Sandy called at that time, but she was an A-10 pilot and talked about the rescue mission. And then we had some of the McKay Trophy winners from earlier in that war, MH-53 guys from the 20th SOS at Herbie come out and talk to us. And I remember as a cadet in Mitchell Hall, they were hearing them talk at the staff tower, and I was just stoked. I thought it was super wild what they were doing, and them interacting with the environment with brownouts and the mountains and problem solving and just like getting people out by the skin of their teeth was pretty cool. I just left USAFA as an AOC, and that was wild to go back and develop the youngsters there and our future leaders. But I would tell them, as far as CSAR goes, it's like being on a sports team for your whole life, basically, from pararescue to the pilots, to the backenders, to our special mission aviators, who are our flight engineer gunners. But the idea is, like you said, we go to the worst place on earth for the next 15 minutes. And it's probably a setup to try to kill us also. And that's a pretty wild job. Everybody else is leaving that place, and we're trying to get there as fast as we can, and we don't know much about it. And we just update our info as we approach it. And from my combat experiences, I think the goal is to have enough game plans and plays in your playbook. You can react and engage and try to get that survivor. And then the goal really is to have the willpower to fight, and then the ability to survive your mistakes so that you get another chance. So you just make a bunch of mistakes and survive them because you have enough talent and enough luck and skill and training. And then you're still alive and you get another chance and you finally pull it off.
Well, it's like we can train and we can train and we can train, but the enemy always gets a vote.
Right.
The plan always provides first contact with the enemy. Tremendous amount of respect for guys flying helos. You're flying down low in the dirt. And like you said, you're going to where, especially doing combat search and rescue, you're going where everyone else is trying to leave and you're this hovering target, which we're going to talk about some of your stories here in a little bit, which to me are just like amazing. With that, what does a like normal deployment look like for a rescue pilot?
Sure. So I think it depends a lot, as everything does, right, on like where you're going and what the current operations are. Back in the surge in Afghanistan, we would have a 1-2 dwell or a 1-1 dwell. So you would be deployed 4 months and you'd be back maybe 8 months and then you go back 4 months. The Army was doing a year and a half, and we would see the same Army troopers on the same deployment after we'd been back home for almost a year, and they're still there. So that would humble us when we think we'd have it hard, basically. But we deploy, at that time we'd go to Bagram, and then we would pre-position and support different Army missions. And what we were doing there was flying CASEVAC, casualty evacuation, but we were always holding CSAR, combat search and rescue alert. So like Rain, if you had a sick jet and you had to get out, we were always on call to drop even a CASEVAC mission and press straight to go get you in that situation. But flying the CASEVAC, we were armed. We had typically dual 50 cals in a formation, so a two ship. And we would have Apache Rescort or Kiowa Rescort. And we would be able to go into, assume a lot of risk, go into hot LZs, troops in contact, to pull folks out of really bad situations that often the dust off birds couldn't survive that low energy state in the hover, since they were unarmed, the Army dust offs, Blackhawks.
That's what I know. So dust offs, those are unarmed?
Yes. So the dust off birds traditionally have the Red Cross on the nose and super brave aircrew that just throw a band into the wind and go in to get dudes unarmed, following, you know, full concepts, Geneva Convention, the medical evacuation bird.
I did not know that, because to me, that's phenomenal. I know
it's super awesome.
Yeah, there's no,
it's super brave.
Yeah, there's no insurgents that's playing by the Geneva Convention.
Nope.
So these guys and gals going out there to do that, like, hats off. I learned something. That's phenomenal. Because I mean, you know, my experience again is that 1 year that I spent with the rescue squadron, all the training sorties were go fight your way in, fight your way back out. You were armed. Granted, you're still a helicopter, but you had the ability to return fire. And usually you had A-10s or something like that that were providing rescort.
Right.
What, man. So with that being said, were you guys integrated with the Army? I would imagine this is kind of like if you're sitting alert, they have Apaches that are sitting alert that you guys are going to launch as a formation. And they're going to provide cover for you if you're going somewhere, right?
Occasionally, but we were, Air Force Rescue is a pretty cool thing because it's this cohesive team effort that's pretty organic. So we have, it's the triad. We have the rescue tanker, the HC-130, and then we have the PJ's pararescue, and then we have the Jolly aircrew, special mission aviators and pilots. And so we can do our mission self-supporting. And then Afghanistan, in my experience at least, was pretty much a pickup game. If we were a formation, we would ask for any attack weapons teams to just join us as we went in for the casualty evacuation pickups. So invariably there'd be two Apaches or an Apache and a Kiowa as a dual gun team. And we would kind of grab them as we went. And then we would make an effort pre-deployed, pre-positioned with the attack weapons pilots to talk to them about their tactics and our terminology, so that we could integrate a little smoother than just having never met each other and shown up. But we typically wouldn't launch together. We would pick them up as we roll into the terminal area.
I know it depends. Again, we're gonna dive into two of your sorties here, but on average, were you guys pretty busy, or was it just flying or sitting alert or doing CASEVAC?
Right. So right now, what deployments look like is we sit alert for CSAR. And we can sit ground alert, airborne alert, push forward as required for some of the stories you guys have been talking about on the podcast recently. But back then, we were getting a lot of missions. And the guys in the south in Kandahar and then in the west in Bastion, they were getting like 12 missions a day. IED blast, troops in contact. And there's some good podcasts on that stuff too, but they would just, you know, go into the zone with repeated under fire actions, pull dudes out, bring them to the medical center and come right back out. And super gruesome stuff, like people trapped in minefields, hovering off, kind of the carnage from that is the only hover references they have. And they can't descend below the hoist height. Like, they're up at 200 feet, maybe 150 feet, because if they go lower, there's a risk they set off the IEDs with a helicopter. So you've got a PJ on the hoist, putting one foot down on the ground, like bear hugging somebody and bringing them up. And so they were super busy. And then up in Bagram, my experience was that we would have very intense missions that would be usually off of an army operation. But we've had less constant missions as far as like every day. But when the army decided to fight force on force, we would be first up because we were armed for that casualty evacuation. And we would just get attack weapons to cover us and our second aircraft, and we'd go in and pull these folks out.
And it's wild. And I know, like, for me, it was always, I mean, I think for every aviator, knowing that you guys are out there, if I'm going to have a really bad day, there's going to be brothers in arms that are going to come pick you up, like, is a huge, huge factor of being able to go push forward. I'm just trying to think, like, it's wild. My last deployment, it was Operation Hand Resolve, and that was such a new kickoff that we were flying outside of the ranges where, like, you guys would be able to reach us very quickly. And we actually had a Jordanian go down well inside Syria. And I think that changed a lot of like how the dynamics of places went, but that requires you guys to forward deploy to, I would say, less than your normal Air Force locations, right?
Right. So we are forward of the normal Air Force locations. And post the tragedy with the Jordanian pilot, we, Air Force Rescue, CSAR, re-entered the we were there, but we got a lot closer following that.
Makes a big difference.
Yeah, for sure. And then we're able to kind of support the intensity of the strikes and be able to react quicker when those are going on, when we integrate.
Yeah, no doubt. Well, I'm going to start digging into a sortie here. So this is March 29th, 2011, and you're awarded the Distinguished Flying Cross. March 29th, 2011, you were alerted to an urgent evacuation request for soldiers that were critically wounded by enemy fire. After coordinating attack helicopters to mitigate the threat in the landing zone and receiving high-risk mission approval from the Combined Air Operations Center director, there's occasionally some red tape, but that requires, I mean, a few phone calls or SATCOM, I would imagine, to get that approval, right?
That's right. Yeah, that's a SATCOM call, usually from our enlisted gunner who is passing flight lead's words, because flight lead's busy integrating with attack weapons. And so they're passing words to the KOC to get that approval, or to our operations center locally to then get that approval.
Yeah. And the approval there too, it's an acceptable level of risk, right? That he's determining and owning, like, is it worth sending this helicopter and this crew into harm's way with a chance of not coming back?
That's right. And with the consideration, this is a force on force Army combat operation, but their primary mission is CSAR. So am I willing them to accept high risk, possibly get damaged, shot down doing that, and then not be able to support you guys in the fast jets?
You always want to help out, but if you get killed or if you get damaged and have to, and you go down, now it's, we're rescuing four more people in addition to the four people that needed rescuing in the first place.
Right. Like, CSAR is unique in that all need return. Yes. Whereas if you're on a strike mission and you hit your target, if it's a serious enough target, you know, some dudes might not come back and it's a mission success. But usually with the considerations, the full spectrum considerations for CSAR, you need everybody back or you just exponentially make the problem worse.
In the CSAR world, Hilo world, do you guys use acceptable level of risk, or do you have another? It's same concept. Basically, hey, we're willing to accept a loss here for mission success or no losses.
That's right. And that would depend on what that operation is, right? And I think Afghanistan was very intense combat, but it was typically small arms fire up to Dishka, so 50 caliber and RPG. And if you had a sick jet in the zone there, you could go to a FOB. There were FOBs, forward operating bases, with fuel and ammo within 20 minutes of almost anywhere we would be. So we had a very survivable, permissive ability to escape that terminal area. Whereas if we're talking about Syria area or something, fuller spectrum, if you have a sick aircraft, you got to get out of there quick, because you can't beat it up in the zone and trade fire like you can if you can just go precautionary, land your bird 10 minutes later, and then get to the spare aircraft and then continue the mission, because you have such a logistical base in Afghanistan like we did.
A well-established, completely different fight than from what's going on next door or what was going on
right
next door. So you skillfully flew an approach through a channelized terrain and mountainous terrain with only feet between the rotor system and the rock face. Captain Nolden kept a solid 120-foot hover while preparing for a hoist extraction. So for me, all that sounds terrible, spinning blades of death into from your head right next to a rock wall. I would imagine the higher you are, the tougher it is for the hover and dropping it. Is that true or not?
That's true. There's more power required. So aerodynamically, it's costs more to keep that helicopter stable at that height. There's no ground effect. And you're trying to hit this basically loose cable, like a super long climbing rope, and get it possibly onto a roof or onto a boulder in the mountains and grab a dude who's wounded or trapped down there and pull him out. So you have to be pretty accurate with it. So at that point, the pilots, we have hover cues that we can use when we're that high and we don't have good outside references, or it's really dark over the water. And we have acceleration velocity cues we can center on themselves and hover heads in on the FLIR image, kind of like a HUD tape for you guys, but a heads down display for us. And then the FE, the flight engineer, is just calling us right to back one. And they're basically flying the aircraft with their voice, and they're looking at 90 degrees to our orientation. So their right is forward to them, but they have to say right for us. And it's super crew intensive. Calm voices matter a lot. Pilot not flying, helping out the pilot who's flying, and everybody's voice just keeping the next one calmer and getting the job done with a lot of precision with that hover work.
So there, a lot happens between the time I just said, hey, you got alerted, to the fact that you're 120 feet over the area and getting ready to do a hoist extraction. What is the process from getting alerted? Is it just, hey, here's the grids and go, and then a JTAC frequency, or are you talking to C2? How do you get to that spot where you're hovering?
So we had pre-positioned to a FOB called Joyce near Assadabad, and we were literally one mountain ridge from this battle, and we could just hear it as it intensified. And then when the Army howitzer, the 105, started going off with its GPS-guided 105, we knew, like, our missions were coming, basically. And this operation was Strong Eagle 2, and the 82nd Airborne infilled 600 troopers with Chinook lifts into a mountain valley, and they patrolled both sides down and into a Taliban stronghold and fought their way through it. And I think we had like 12 missions in the first day, picking up dudes with broken ankles, gunshot wounds, and making sure that those troops on the ground could continue to maneuver and not just stay in place and support the wounded soldier. And so those were our night missions. I was the co-pilot on Chalk 2, and this is my second deployment. And we had a team where I was with a pilot, good friend who had flown Huey's first assignment and then had switched to PAPOC. So he's an experienced aviator, and this was his first deployment as a aircraft commander or a mission pilot. And I was trying to just support him and help him with whatever he needed. And as we're going into the zone, he asks, hey, do you want to fly this approach? And it was the first approach I was going to fly for our team, basically, in the zone. I was like, sure, yeah, I'll take it. I'm feeling good. And as we roll in, we had waited to get Apaches, and they were rearming. I think it was a Kiowa also. And so they'd rearmed, and we'd waited. And with these CAT Alphas, these super wounded 82nd Airborne Troopers to roll in to support them. And as we roll in, there's a JPAC on the Freak. And as we roll into the valley, flight lead, all of his flares jettison off the aircraft. And it was some electrical glitch. And they just auto jettisoned. And the JSTAC starts saying, hey, lead just had a missile shot or shot down or something. And we're just like in shock too, like almost laughing, like, what is happening? And did you hit the jettison switch? And they're like, no, we didn't. And that was a go-no-go for us for manpad threats. And they're like, well, these dudes need us, so we're going to just press anyways, and we'll stay in the overhead. We're going to press in. And so, you know, for some reason, I was chalk to co-pilot. So I had, if you have SA, you can have a lot of SA because you're making the least amount of decisions. And I was talking to the ground team, and I think their call sign was Wolverine. And I remember asking Wolverine, say, location, last known threat. And they said accurate sniper fire 10 minutes ago. And I was like, oh, cool. Okay, that's high fidelity. And we just press in, right? And as we roll in, we ask them to pop their smoke. We're on secure radios, so the Taliban probably can't hear us. Ask them to pop. Four different locations pop smoke. That's how intense this battle was. Those were all U.S. soldiers, teams need an evacuation, and we went to the closest smoke. It's a big mountain rock face, big granite rock face, kind of that looks like Eagle's Peak above the Air Force Academy. And they'd been, this squad had been engaged kind of in this little ravine, but it had a huge, like, 1,500 foot slope that as I teardropped in, I briefed my escape route, which we always train to do. And sometimes if you're complacent, you won't brief it, but I did. And I said, hey, I'm going to teardrop in, and I'll line up into the wind. I'll hover off this rock face and we'll do our hoist and get this dude out of here. And escapes will be down and left. We have a little chin bubble by your foot. You can look down. And so as I teardrop in, set up this hoist, our PJ gets on the hoist, and the flight engineer now is half manning his weapon. I think he probably put another PJ on the 50 cal, and then he's running the hoist. And right as we get stable, PJ gets his feet on the side of the aircraft. The ambush that had engaged the soldiers engaged us. And we'd shot our weapons a bunch, but we'd never been shot at in our aircraft. But there was no mistaking what it was. It was basically, I don't know how many rounds went off. It was probably a PKM, so a 7.62 belt-fed machine gun. It engaged us and it hit us five times just on the first burst. And hit retreating edge of the blade. But the Black Hawk is this war machine designed from lessons learned in Vietnam, and it's got a big titanium spar down the blade. So that bullet just hit the spar and went straight up on the blade, didn't hurt anything. One of the bullets, though, hit the right engine deck, the digital electronic control, and broke the circuit breaker in half, or the circuit board, and blew the wire cable off it. So the computer brain of our jet engine just got exploded and it failed to the low side.
Oh, that's convenient.
Super convenient. Could have failed to the high side and helped us hover with a lot of power, but it failed to the low side. And so we got hit. I look straight in and I see all these vertical chiclets. So our aircraft is vertically stacked for our instruments, little lights. The rotor should have been in the green. It was in the red. It was even past the yellow chiclets. And, you know, my immediate reaction was to try to enter an auto rotation from a hover and try to get to our lift over drag max, our bucket speed. And we had this narrow single engine airspeed range we could fly at. So I had to trade our altitude in that hover instantly to get to a survivable airspeed with one engine. Because you can't hover this 18,000-pound helicopter at 7,000 feet with one engine. And the alternative was to just crash the aircraft straight into the ground and try to cushion it as we do a power-assisted vertical descent. And that didn't seem like a good idea. So the other really scary thing was my buddy, one of our PJs, is on the hoist.
I was going to ask, is like, you got to attach the hoist with his foot on the ground, right?
Yeah, no, with his foot on the helicopter floor, ready to go down. But it's unclear to me how far the hoist he's down. And so it's the philosophy 101 boxcar dilemma. And it's like, well, you know, I'm going to save six dudes and maybe sacrifice one. And it's super tragic if this happens. But man, I really hope he gets in the aircraft. And so this, one of my first instructors, Rocky, had shown me how to do a 180 auto in the 60, which was a lot different than our pilot training Huey. You got to just dump the nose and basically do an aileron roll and pull it around with collective to maneuver it for that type of maneuver. So from that hover, I pointed it basically straight at the ground, did it 30 degrees nose low at least, did an aileron roll in effect, even though it's rotary wing, right? But that's kind of what it'd feel like. And then dumped the collective as I did that. And as we just plummeted towards the ground to just trade that potential energy into kinetic, I was just getting ready to crash it into the rocks and flare it to make it as survivable as possible. But then I saw the rotor was actually not stalled. And we were flying at about 89, 90% NR. The generators kick off at 88 and all your anti-ice fails open and robs you of all your power. And probably all your electronic displays too.
Yeah, things you want to default to the high side or like, you know, like, yeah, it's not helping me right now.
Right, exactly. And so I roll out of this and I had this very vivid, like out of body experience where I was just watching myself and my hand fly the rotor with the collective. And I flash back to our wedding and all my friends flying Pavehawks. And I was just like, you lucky guys, like, how is this happening to me? And I just couldn't believe it. And then I was like, hey, we are going to crash, but I think I'm going to, you know, I was thinking about me and the crew. I think some of us are going to survive this. And then I was really worried my rifle would be bent where it was stowed next to me in the armor wing and I wouldn't be able to defend the helicopter. And then we just kept flying and we come around the corner and the pilot, my buddy, mission pilot takes the controls. And I was lining up to roll us into a poppy field and basically crash land us because my SA was just zero. And he takes the controls. And I was like, at first, a little like, hey, let me finish this, man. But then he took them and said, hey, we're still flying. And I was like, oh, yeah, we're still flying. And I said, what happened? And he says, our engine shot out. And that was like horrifying to hear that, even though it already happened and we'd survived it. And then I asked, hey, is Yuri still alive? Is our PJ still there? And they're like, yeah, dude, he jumped in right as it happened. And for our whole crew, that's just incredible luck. And it was pretty amazing to get the crew out of that situation all in one piece. And so then we had what you call, right, like a non-1 EP. Like, there's nothing that describes the indications we were seeing.
Yeah.
But we had battle damage, you know, fire fought, frozen battle damage, shut that engine down. And then really good flight leadership from my mission pilot now says, hey, let's take it to the runway at Jalalabad and we'll roll this on. And like an airplane, kind of like the Chinook pilot was talking about from the forest fires.
Helicopters are another world to me, but like a roll on landing. And then it makes sense if you're underpowered, you obviously don't, like, you're going to require more power to hover and sit at the
right. Helmet.
Roll on landings make sense to me. But you know, I know right. Helicopters do that too.
Yeah, yeah. So we can do a roll on landing. It's a tail dragger in the Blackhawk or the Pavehawk, and then you can aero brake it super effectively. But I, in my mind, my SA was still rebuilding, and I was like, well, you know, we can kind of like do a single engine approach to a spot into a fob, or roll it onto a road in front of the fob and brave the landmines and try to get picked up by a team. And then he's like, we'll just take it to a runway. I was like, oh, that's a way better idea.
I like this. But it's funny. I mean, you get obviously wrapped up in the moment, and having a crew is super helpful, right? Because there are going to be, hopefully, different bits of information. Someone else is building their SA while yours is dumped, singularly focused on just initial survival of this event. So it's kind of nice to have two people in there, assuming the person's not an SA drain.
Right. No, it saved our lives. We had two pilots, two special mission aviators, and then two or three PJs. And I remember the PJs telling me, they said, the only call we got out of the aircraft too was contact, contact, contact from one of the PJs flight lead heard us and was like, why are they flying down the valley? Because it's so hard daytime to see point of origin. You have to literally be staring as it as they shoot at you or you can't catch it. And so they bravely followed us, expecting to maybe flame out and have to auto-rotate coming into Jalalabad to be our chase ship. And we tried to get some up.
Are you a passionate aviation enthusiast? Then you'll be thrilled to hear about our sponsor, Aircore Aviation. This exciting company has been revolutionizing the aviation industry since 2008, and they have some amazing career opportunities available. More about that in just a minute. Aircore Aviation is at the forefront of airworthiness of legacy aircraft dating all the way back to World War II. Their dedicated team is involved in various aspects of aerospace, including manufacturing, fabrication, restoration, and support, using state-of-the-art technology. Their exceptional expertise in core manufacturing capabilities like metal forming, CNC machining, and complete aircraft rebuilding has led to the restoration of some award-winning aircraft, such as a couple P-51s, such as P-51 Thunderbird, Twilight Tier, and Sierra Sioux 2. And if you've been following me for a while, you might remember I was fortunate enough to fly over the Super Bowl in 2018 in Minneapolis. The formation was led by Sierra Sioux 2 alongside two A-10s and myself in the F-16, so this is a very cool full-circle experience. These incredible achievements have captured the attention of aircraft owners, aviation enthusiasts, and the general public alike. If you've always dreamt of a career in aviation, then Aircore Aviation is the perfect place for you. They are rapidly expanding their team in 2024 and have job openings in departments such as engineering and CAD, quality assurance, fabrication, and restoration. This is your chance to turn a passion into profession. Aircore Aviation is offering some amazing benefits for full-time positions, including health insurance, PTO, HSA, retirement plans, life insurance, and the extra perk of enjoying Fridays off. If you're ready to be part of a team dedicated to fulfilling the dreams through the preservation of historical aircraft, visit aircoreaviation.com/careers today and take the first step towards an exciting career in aviation. Again, that's aircoreaviation.com/careers. Don't miss out on this incredible opportunity.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Apaches to follow us, but they were busy just slaying people up in the mountain there and were pretty focused on that. And so we self-supported our own escape. And then we flew down the Konar River at about, you know, 75 feet, talking through how we do a low altitude auto if we took a kite or more battle damage or birds into the good engine, trying to like land on a sandbar or the beach or something and defend ourselves till an MRAP could get to us. But we got to Jalalabad there. But back to the PJs, they said, hey, when we first got hit, we're pretty sure we were going to die. Then we were pretty sure we were going to live. Then flying down the river, when you started talking about us like swimming out of the helicopter, if we had to auto it, we were pretty sure we were going to die again.
It's a roller coaster of emotions.
Yes.
Dude, I can't imagine. I imagine daytime, or even I don't know what the insurgents were doing at that time, if they were using tracers or not. But like you said, daytime, finding a point of origin where that stuff's coming from. You're basically looking for dust kicking up, which in the mountains, everything is tan and green. Probably a pretty low probability that you're actually going to see where that port of origin came from.
It's even surprisingly low probability. Even if you know all that, you think, hey, I'm in a helicopter in the overhead. I'm looking at my dude, your chalk two or your flight lead. I know I can see if they get engaged. But you really can't. Like you can if you're lucky and you just are looking right at that spot as it happens. But like you said, I can't recall if there were tracers that day, but it's just phenomenally difficult, even at 100 feet, to spot that, let alone in a fast jet spotting that.
Yeah, no, I mean, there's no way you would, unless you have tracer rounds, and obviously there's going to be bigger stuff shooting at faster jets, but nighttime with a targeting pod, best case scenario, you're going to see a hot spot. Maybe looking out with like MVGs, if they're shooting tracers or something like that, you'd be able to pick it up. But nothing of use, especially in that terrain with, you know, steep mountains and things like that. in the fast jet, you're not going to have total view the entire time as you're up there in the orbit. So,
right.
Completely different world. And to me, it's phenomenal what you guys do, because you're risking it going in there, definitely hanging it out and in the hover and just a sitting target. And I can imagine every insurgent in the world would love it nothing more than to shoot down a U.S. helicopter, or any helicopter for that matter.
Right. Yeah, no, I mean, it's very much their goal in those situations is a SAR trap or some sort of ambush for the rescue vehicle when we get there.
You mentioned that you guys are about 7,000 feet up in the mountains. So helicopter-wise, that's probably getting pretty close to max performing it, depending on your fuel weight, how many bodies you got in there, right? I know it can go higher, but can you talk me through some of the challenges of flying around at that altitude and that terrain?
Right. So flying around that terrain, you want to use the winds to your advantage, right? So on the updrafts there, watch out for demarcation lines where you get a lot of turbulence coming off the ridges. But with our power calcs, we're running on our CDU, and with our flight engineer, how much it'll take to hover. And with fuel as close as it was, we would fuel dump to about 20 minutes of usable gas every pickup in that situation. So we would just fly max fuel. And then once we knew what the pickup was like, we would dump to 20 minutes of gas and commit to the zone and try to get those dudes out. And so you were like both committed threat-wise to getting them out and injury-wise for them. And then you only had like 10 minutes of gas with a bingo factored in to get to your base to refuel. So we were being pretty precise with the fuel dumps, and occasionally could get a rescue tanker or an AFSOC tanker to give us some gas. But at those altitudes, that's hard to get them off their mission set unless they're just supporting us for a CSAR-type mission.
A completely different world than what I'm used to, and it's like phenomenal just to hear that story. I would like to shift gears to another Distinguished Flying Cross that you received, which was just, what, about a month later?
That's right, yeah. So, yeah, about 25 days later or whatever.
Part 2 for episode number 17 is available to download right now. And to sum it up, Shiner is a bullet magnet. You're listening to the Afterburn Podcast, part 2 of episode number 17.
So in my mind, it goes from, man, we're so lucky to see this person snatch him just with the hoist, get out of here, or with the air land. But now it's going to be doubly complicated, and we're going to commit our ground forces to the battle. And it takes a serious turn in that case for us.
Again, that's Shiner talking about his second sortie in this episode, which was a little sporty to say the least. So with that being said, let's get into part 2 of episode number 17 with Shiner.
That's right. Yeah. So yeah, about 25 days later or whatever.
Yeah. So I have it here. Yeah. April 23rd, 2011. This one, you're tasked to rescue two Army pilots down in enemy-controlled territory 25 miles east of Bagram. You navigated your aircraft around the enemy position to the crash site and began recovery operations. And during the initial insertion, you received enemy fire, striking the cabin and injuring one of your flight engineers. So can you kick off the day? Were you sitting alert, or were you guys tasked with a mission that day?
Yeah, so we were sitting alert. I was asleep on the crew couch, kind of like sleeping on my arm that fell asleep. And somebody runs in, it's dark, and they're like, hey, fallen angel, which is the code, right, for downed aircraft. And usually we're doing CASAVAC. We're always on CSAR alert, but we, you know, it's such a rare event that it's usually a false positive, right? And so I'm like, hey, fallen angel, like, are you sure? And they're like, yeah, let's get to the aircraft. So we get to the aircraft, and it was kind of cool. Well, I wouldn't say it's cool, but when that aircraft went down, their wingman called for Pedro, just was our call sign. And they just called for Air Force Rescue straight away. And so when the CAOC called our DO, they said, hey, a Pedro's down. And he runs outside and he looks at all three of our aircraft and he runs back and he's like, nope, we're all here. We're good. What, is somebody else down? And they're like, oh yeah, no, looks like a Army helicopter's gone down and they're asking for Pedro. And so we launch and we have an initial approximate location. It's about you know, 25, 30 minutes from Bagram. It was in the French controlled AO and pretty rugged terrain up there, RC East, the mountainous area of Afghanistan. And so we launch and we're chalked to same crew as the month before, test fire our weapons, all four of them work, which is great. We enter, we've got Strike Eagles overhead, and we've got another Army Kiowa overhead, and I think at this time an Apache as well. And the aircraft that went down was an OH-58 Delta Army Kiowa, so a very lightweight Army attack helicopter. And they're flying a familiarization flight of the local area. So they were a mixed crew, and they took a 1 in 1,000 shot off a ridge. And the pilot flew it well enough to save the co-pilot's life as they crashed. Pilot's killed in the crash. And so the co egresses, can't get the pilot out, and then decides to basically defend the aircraft with his M4. But he's got a broken back and a fractured jaw. And he climbs 500 vertical feet and then does an overwatch of the downed aircraft with his weapon and is getting on the radio. And as we turn the corner, basically, NBGs, we see his strobe going off and hear the Apache talking to us, see him lasing him. And I mean, to me at that point in time, it's just like a movie. I was like, this is amazing. We're so lucky we see the survivor. We're going to commit right away to get him out, because the fear is, you know, you can't talk to the survivor, you can't find him, and or you see him and then you can't see him. But in this case, we see him, IR strobe. Lead goes in and realizes at this point that survivor is separated from the aircraft. And you never want to split your forces, typically, in this case, our ground team of pararescue, but we did not think it was like vertically separated by such rugged terrain. And so they stayed in the zone with the co-pilot, and we then were spun in as chalk two to the crash site.
There's obviously confusion that's going on, and there's some things you're overcoming, just like there's survivors up the hill and the crash site's 500 meters away, right? How did you guys navigate and like narrow that down? Is it purely like you're seeing his strobe and like, how do you know that's him versus like an enemy strobe?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And this is, if you have an on-scene commander, basically a wingman who can keep chain of custody visually, that's basically what happened here. And that Apache secure radios with us was just certain that was the co-pilot or one of the pilots, right? And we were integrated with that Apache at that point. So we just used that person as the on-scene commander, chain of custody since the crash. And we're very confident that that was not a spoofer or a SAR trap to get that pilot with the IR strobe out. So we're very confident that that was that person. And then as they're trying to hoist him up, you start hearing, hey, trapped in the wreckage, trapped in the wreckage. And we shift. Oh, got it. Okay. So this is going to be probably have to put in both our pararescue teams. We have some power tools that they can use to get dudes out of armor or an aircraft. And so we're kind of expecting. So in my mind, it goes from, man, we're so lucky to see this person snatch him just with the hoist, get out of here, or with the air land. But now it's going to be doubly complicated, and we're going to commit our ground forces to the battle. And it takes a serious turn in that case for us.
So for you guys, you're putting down by the crash site right then and dropping the PJs off so they can work. Am I understanding that correctly?
Right. So at this point in time, flight lead infilled their combat rescue officer and their two pararescuemen via a hoist to the co-pilot and directed us to spin to the zone to the crash site. And then our pararescue is going to overland, move, and link up. And so at that point in time, it's just getting to be dawn, but it's still dark. And for some reason, I look down and I see the rotor system in the crashed Kiowa. And I'm the only crew member that sees it. And so I take the controls, spin into the zone there, and it's super rugged terrain with the hill to one side. The hoist is on the outside of the terrain, so we have to be even higher for that angle to work. And we do like a 150-foot hoist to get our two PJs into the zone there. And right as we infill our two PJs, we took very effective sniper fire and went straight through the floor and through our flight engineer's leg. And he just calls FE hit as we react to that fire and lay some suppressing fire down from the other side and go around. And at that point, I'm taking off into the rising sun with PNVGs on. So four goggled NVGs staring into the sun with a crew member wounded. I'm blind on flight lead and somebody else wires. And there's these big gondola cables strung across the valley that they would transfer stuff across this pretty rugged river. And I couldn't even see him. And I just was telling lead, hey, I'm blind. I don't want to hit you. We took fire. Crew member's wounded. Trying not to hit these wires. And I'm staring at the sun on night vision goggles that I'm trying to slap off my helmet. So I can see, basically. Flight lead says, hey, we're saddled off you. We're not going to hit you. Just keep flying. And we'd had a good friend, a pilot wounded, who had been flown back. And there were some good lessons learned from that. And we had talked about if a crew member was wounded, kind of what to do if the mission permitted. And this is, you know, per that space and time in Afghanistan conditions and all that, support assets. But my friend kind of had this joke. He's like, well, if it's CSAR, if you can take out the combat in the search and just do the rescue and they're a crew member, it's pretty simple. You just fly them straight to the hospital.
Right.
And so that's where we were at. And me and Phil, the pilot, we agreed, hey, yeah, we're going to fly them straight to the hospital. So we go straight to Bagram. They send around an F-15 and a C-17 and let us land straight to the medical station. And the only time at 50 drop-offs there, maybe 100, I don't know, that the we weren't met by medical staff. So
classic.
Our PJs are on the ground, right? So our gunner is treating our flight engineer. Our flight engineer probably weighs 300 pounds with his gear. So my gunner and I pick him up, and we have to run them 50 to 100 meters up into the ER. And a Marine Prowler pilot wakes up out of his tent and runs over to help us in his underwear. So three of us are carrying Jim up, trying not to hurt him. Super brave dude. And he's gutting through it. And we get to this padlock at the gate at the hospital. And I'm like, I don't know the code. The PJs know the code. I don't know the code. And I look at my M9 on my desk and I'm like, well, I could try to shoot the lock open. And I'm like, that's probably a terrible idea. Right as nurses show up and open the gate for us. So thank God I didn't have to solve that problem.
Send the base into lockdown.
Yeah, exactly. With a maniac pilot trying to charge the hospital. So then we drop our flight engineer off the hospital. I run back. I'm strapping in. And our gunner's still in the hospital. I'm like, oh no. And we're covered in blood from our flight engineer. So I run back in and they're trying to cut his vest and flight suit off. And I run in and it's an operating room with a Army surgeon, and she's trying to cut his vest off. And I'm like, hey Konzo, are you wounded? And he says, no. I'm like, okay, come with me then.
It's time to
go. And I'm yelling, and the surgeon, she's a colonel, looks at me, and she's like, do not raise your voice in my operating room. And I'm like, yes, ma'am. And sorry, ma'am. And I grab my gunner, and we run back to the helicopter, and they worked hard to save our FC's life. And then we had fantastic leadership this whole mission. And they say, hey, fly without your flight engineer, do a battle damage check, and then come pick up a spare and get back to the fight. So I grabbed this Chinook maintenance crew as the rest of our crew is hot gassing. And I grabbed these dudes and I'm like, hey, come with me and count the bullet holes in my aircraft and tell me how many you get. Count them independently and let's see if we get the same number. And so there had been blood sprayed on the tail through one of the holes in the floor. It was super gruesome, bunch of bullet holes. We compare them. I thank them for their help. We go get our senior enlisted member who hops on board, having been asleep like 30 minutes before, gets into a pretty gruesome crew position. And before he's even strapped in, we just vertical take off straight back to the fight. And we enter this turning rejoin with lead, and I'm like rotor to rotor, pulling too much torque, and he's screaming at me to torque down. and I can't, or I'll collide, and I rust into this rejoin, and I finally mellow it out and get saddled this track too. And he's just like, you guys need to calm down and tell me what's happening. And for the rest of that flight, he was this voice of reason that just like kept us caged.
Yeah.
And so we told him what was happening. In the meantime, flight lead had gotten out the co-pilot and his three guardians, and our two PJs were still trapped taking fire at the wreckage. So they decided to cover us on one attempt at a hoist exfil for our two PJs and the pilot at the crash site. So we go in, stable hover, in that same firing position, enemy firing position, probably single shot, maybe multiple shots, but straight through our new flight engineer's helmet.
Dang.
Straight through Scuba's helmet. Hit the right side of his helmet, conformed around the foam, and then went out the left side. And, you know,
dude,
wait, like, gets thrown basically between the pilots, returns fire with one hand with his 50 cal as we go around. And that's like hour one and a half of what became a 5-hour mission trading strafing rounds. So we had a hot mic on the primary, one of the cast frequencies. So we were on a single open frequency trading A-10 Apache and Paphawk gun runs with our non-JTAC PJs calling in the fires off of their position for the rest of the day, basically.
I know this happened, this is way back in your story, but one, I want to highlight the fact of like the NVGs, like the worst time to be flying, I think, is the transition between daytime and nighttime and nighttime and daytime, because you can't see with your naked eye and your NVGs are basically worthless at that point. So overcoming that aspect and that terrain, because you got shadows and all sorts of stuff. So I know you guys are working really hard to get through that. So hats off there, but I do want to fast forward back to the PJs. So those guys are calling in airstrikes, and basically, are you guys just doing self-deconfliction between you, the A-10, the Apaches? How did all that go down?
Right. So I think we're at 75 feet at one point here, and the A-10s are like, hey, you know, sector west or whatever, we're coming in. And so an A-10 flies under us. We're at 75 feet. And the A-10 flies under us at 50 feet with their gun going, and then just G-pulse straight through the horizon. You see that iron cross as they pull through the mountain ridge. And I was just like, this is insane. But it was safe. We were all professional aviators along with the Apaches. It was extreme in that we didn't have a JTAC. It was basically call for fire, five line off of the PJs. And it was off of the PJs' best guess of where they were taking fire in their position. And they had to stay hidden, basically. And they heard voices around them the whole day and took fire above their heads within meters for the entire day, but never compromised their position and really had to make tough choices between kind of doing a last stand. They only probably had three M4 magazines each, and decided to use the air assets we had. And so, yeah, we deconflicted by saying, hey, offset to this side, go to this altitude. And then we had a hog team of four, and then we had a sandy team of four. And we also had strike eagles overhead. And we had like MC-12, probably a MQ-1 at the time.
Yeah.
Like we had a B-1 at one point. So at this point in time, this was the largest unplanned mission in Afghanistan history for the U.S. We had contract pilots who were former, you know, like 05s or 06s cruising around.
Right.
And they would switch to our frequency and they're like, hey, it's Bill from this squadron. Good luck, guys. And then they'd switch frequency and fly off. And so we'd get like fist pumps from the retired cadre as they cruise through Afghanistan.
What a different world. I mean, it's just kind of, it's kind of surreal.
Yeah, it was pretty weird.
That's a 5-hour mission. I'm assuming that's because that's how long it's taken the PJs to get the deceased pilot out of the Kiowa.
No. So it's actually us trying to rescue our PJs. And we... So flight lead had taken heavy battle damage as we were getting our second flight engineer. Their transmission fluid was draining out of the aircraft that lubricates the mast, the spinning rotor, basically. and it's kind of all bets are off once that's dry. You have 0 minutes or you have 30 minutes until you're an 18-pound car in the air that just falls out of the sky, right? And so they bravely stay in the zone, cover it, send that one pass, and then they go shut it down, and it's bone dry by the time they shut down. And they get the pilot that survived the crash onto an Army Blackhawk to take that person to Bagram. And then we're doing a battle damage check, and I see Scuba's helmet at that point. And I'm like, dude, did you see this? Do you see your helmet? And he's like, yeah, don't tell the rest of the dudes. I don't want to freak them out. And I'm like, bro, we're pretty freaked out. But super brave guy. And we had a team discussion, our flight engineers. We got all the PJ team from Bagram now to this French FOB. And this French dude runs up as we're having the conversation with a bunch of pastries. And he's like, they are French. They are good. Enjoy them. And we're like, thanks, bro. we have this conversation and we're all like, yeah, let's get an Apache as a wingman and let's go back in. And so we start back up. And now our flight lead is waiting to get a ride back to Bagram to get the spare aircraft to come back out. And the maintenance crews, who are amazing, are getting that beast ready to fly with good ammo loaded and all that. So at any rate, there's an Army 06 now and an Apache overhead. And we ask him, hey, can you be our wingman for these passes? And he says, yeah, absolutely. So we go in and we get shot out of the zone again. We're 5 miles from the PJs and we take fire through the floor. And Phil and I look at each other and just shake our heads like this whole village is trying to kill us. Yeah. And the gunner is like, hey guys, that just went through my knee pad and into the ceiling, but I'm okay. We're like, all right, bro. And then like we just start circling, waiting for the Apaches and A-10s to make it more permissive. And everybody's exhausted at this point. And I kind of like wake up out of this daze and start jinking the aircraft, expecting some sort of missile to come at us, get to this ridge line. And we're like, hey, we got to recage. We're getting tired. And at this point, we get gas again. And Army quick reaction force super heroically gets infilled across the river as a blocking force to basically sacrifice themselves to get our PJs out of there. And so they infill this multiple soldier team who had zero crew rest from their last quick reaction force mission. Those Blackhawks take RPG shots, and two of those troopers are wounded within the first like 5 minutes of them being on the riverside of this village. And one of the dudes is killed, the other is shot through the chest. And so now we keep talking to our guardian. So our two PJs keep saying, hey, man, we're going to get you out of here. You dudes are okay right now. You're not wounded. We got to get these Army guys out, and then we'll come get you. And we have the rest of the PJ team in the back of our aircraft now. And for some reason, again, I see this VS-17 panel take the controls. So this bright orange fabric, basically. We come into a hover in this head-high elephant grass next to all these Adobe or Kalat windows that are just dark now because it's daytime and there's no lights on inside. And there had been intercepted chatter that, like, and we saw all the civilians leave the village during part of this battle.
Yeah, perfect. So, like, spot.
Right. And all the civilians had just, like, marched out of the village with their kids, which was, I mean, good that the villagers had left and these dudes were still trying to kill us. We're just trying to get our PJs out at this point. So I pedal turn. I see the Army dudes running through the elephant grass towards us with the wounded trooper. And then off the nose, I see at least 5 muzzle flashes, basically point blank straight into our face. And I look at Phil and I'm like, hey, should we just like get this dude on board? It's another 20 seconds. No, go around. And it was a good call. Effective fire straight into her face. So we pedal turn, put the left gun on it, and hit it with our cocktail of 50 cal bullets, one of which is an exploding round. And we're sawing, you know, walls in half in this tree as we go around. And I droop the rotor. I pull a ton of power, and you get a low rotor horn in your helmet. Pilot says, hey, low rotor. And I don't respond with a little collective out because I'm still just max performance. So he checks the rotor by just pushing down on the collective. And I have this flood of relief that, hey, he's flying. And then I look over and he's not flying. He was just being a bro and checking the rotor. So I grabbed the controls again. The SEL's wires off the nose, and there are huge gondola cables like 10 feet off the probe. And I pull in more power, droop the rotor again, dump it over the wires with the cyclic. So I rob the rotor of all energy, and we're now in the elephant grass flying out with our gun engaging, and somehow survived that just outrageous engagement. Get into the overhead in flight lead, super brave, great combat leadership. It's just like, hey, you guys have had a rough day. And he's on his second aircraft by this point. He's like, we're going to go into the zone now for the pickup. And I look at Phil, and I had never been so grateful to anybody in my life. And I'm like, wow, we might survive today. And then he calls offset, which is our most dangerous, like, protecting position, is track two, where we hover off him. And I was like, oh, no.
I used to go into like a low hover, like just like.
Yes. Yeah. So I'm like, oh, no, it's even worse.
We're going to be this flag.
Yeah, right. But it was this exposing tactic, but it was really brilliant because he had this play call deep in his mind as an audible, and he just effectively used it. And so we roll in and we have an Apache offset hover on us. So it's lead, then like we're in a 100-foot hover off him with our gun on the threat, Apache above us with their 30mm on the threat. And the second Apache does this perfect purge, like a chandelle, right as lead gets zero energy and the whole village engages us. And so that Apache perching does a return to target and fires a bunch of rockets between our two aircraft and a hover. And we're all just engaging. All the PJs are shooting their M4s. And it's just wild. One of the PJs is a good friend at this point in time, told me everybody was just Winchestering all their ammo. And he's like, wait a second, we don't have the Stokes litter prep for the survivor. And so he did like his primary job, which is to like make sure we can get the survivor. Just everybody else is just unloading on the threat. And just tremendous bravery from, you know, like 18 of us from our rescue team. And then, you know, the Apaches and the Sandies and the Hogs and all those dudes too. And our PJs for just being brave and selfless and not, you know, just being like, yeah, get those dudes first and then come get us. We're going to stay concealed and keep calling gun runs. And so then they fire a hellfire off an Apache, and that quiets it down enough. You could feel that in your chest. We offset 3 miles for that shot. We offset, and then we're able to, lead was able to get out the army dude on that pass. And then Phil, my pilot, had a really brilliant idea and just took a tailwind because we were really low on gas, so we had hover power, so we could accept that, and hovered with the hoist into the terrain, so the angle was smaller and we could be lower, and got our two PJs out. And as we spun in, the hoist wasn't working, and we were just like, oh my God, like, you got to be kidding me. One of the converters had been shot out, and so we had to go to backup mode on the hoist, and that a normal hoist is pretty speedy. Backup mode hoist is painfully slow, especially when you're hovering, in this super hot combat environment for the past 5 hours.
Yeah, and it defaults to the slow speed.
Right, it defaults to the slow speed. And our PJs put on the deceased pilot to recover him first and send him up solo and then come up together. And we blazed out of there back to Bagram, landed, did the correct procedures to reconstitute the deceased pilot, and then got to the squadron. And when we landed, you know, we had fighter dudes from that side of the base, the attack weapons guys who had been flying with us, and we all the maintainers, all our spare air crew, and we just, pretty surreal moment, pretty amazing moment to see all your buddies just like giving you a pat on the back, happy you're alive, you're happy you're alive, glad you were able to get some dudes out of there. And then you look at your aircraft and two are totally unflyable and you're still on CSAR alert. And so we had the spare aircraft that had somehow not been damaged as our, basically our aircraft that we were going to take Apaches or fighters as our escort if we had a CSAR. And then we came off CASAVAC alert for like 2 weeks or something.
Repair the helicopters, or did they have to bring new ones in?
No, our maintenance dudes are champs, and our gun troops had done a great job with our Gal 18s, our 50 cals. We shot six weapons for, you know, 5 hours basically, and none of them had any malfunctions.
That's incredible.
I agree. Yeah, totally amazing. And the sheet metal folks got to work and just started patching these beasts up. They replaced the transmission fluid and the generator that it had drained it out of in the other one. And one of the other shift flew that back from the French Bob to Bagram. And they told them, yeah, just don't touch the tail rotor pedals when you fly this back. And so you can kind of fly a Blackhawk that way. And so he very gingerly got it back to base. And our maintenance dudes just did a Herculean feat and got these things ready to go to combat again.
There's something about being down low and dirty in the mess that obviously makes it really real, because it is real.
Yeah, it's intense.
Well, Shiner, again, I really appreciate you sharing these stories with me. I always like to ask my guests at the end, like, if you found 15-year-old Shiner on the streets and traveled back in time, is there anything you would tell him to do differently or change anything?
Man, I would just tell him to, like, ski as much as humanly possible.
I love it. I love it.
I think one thing I have learned just through, like, I got really good development from our flight leads and instructor pilots, from all the way from UPT through Pavehawk training. And, like, just seeing their maturity. And I think I'd tell young Shiner, like, hey, man, like, the most emotionally satisfying response to, like, initially frustrating things is almost always the wrong answer. So, like, take that deep breath, give them the benefit of the doubt, and just, like, keep calm and carry on, right? And that's the best thing I've learned from rescue, I think, that, you know, trying to get after it as a youth, I could have benefited from.
Sage advice. I wholeheartedly agree. Well, Shiner, thanks again for joining me on the podcast. People are really going to enjoy these stories. I appreciate your time and everything you do.
Thanks, man. See ya.
See ya. Thanks for listening today. I hope you enjoyed today's podcast. Again, wherever you're listening, hit subscribe. And if you can, leave me a rating and review over on iTunes. That definitely helps out. Until next time, don't bring a week.
The Afterburn Podcast is a proud supporter of Guns, Gear, and Memorial Foundation, helping our veterans and their families when they need it most. To learn more, visit GunsGarin.com/rain.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.